Welcome. You are listening to Wordplay. Be right back. WPVM 103.5. Listening to Ali Akbar Khan from the Garden of Dreams. The song is called Power of Joy. This is Sebastian Matthews, and I'm here with Jeff Davis for another issue. another issue of Wordplay. How you doing, Jeff?
Good, Sebastian. How are you doing?
Good. We got Carolyn Mercurio and Marissa Hincraft in town. Did I say it right? What's your last name? Hinchcliffe. Here for us for... Man, I got that so wrong. Another issue of Wordplay.
Are you a fan of the programming on WPVM? As this radio station grows, we invite you to grow with us. Become an underwriter for WPVM. It's a great chance to get involved. You'll reach an expanding audience of motivated, intelligent, and active people. Email underwriting@WPVM.org for more information or call 828-258-0085 with questions. Keep your favorite programming on the air and demonstrate your support for independent grassroots media sources. That's underwriting@WPVM.org.
Yeah, today we're going to do something. A couple weeks back, like 3 weeks ago, we had this incredible poetry festival. And
Wordfest.
Do you remember that? Anybody? Yes, it was good. And so one of the poets we had come in and read, if that's the proper word for us, was Coleman Barks, who appeared Saturday at the Fine Arts in downtown Asheville and did an amazing reading.
That was incredible.
Accompanied by a couple of musicians, Elliot Wadipin, who's a fabulous bass player, and Brian Hedgepath, who played vibes and
drums, all kinds of drums,
all kinds of percussion stuff.
Yeah, that was a great show.
Really, really interesting. So, we're gonna listen to some of that today.
Why not?
Why not?
So we're gonna jump right in, and he begins with Rumi.
Yeah. Now this is he read for like an hour and a half, and so I had to edit. Of course, we're not going to get the whole thing, but so I jumped straight to his Rumi work. He's probably best known, and he talks a little bit about his work with Rumi, but he's probably best known as translator of Rumi.
Yes. We'll start there.
All right.
All right. You're listening to Wordplay on 103.5, the progressive voice of the mountains, WPVM.
Now we'll do four Rumi poems. These are poems from 7.5 centuries ago. They were spoken spontaneously by Rumi, Jalaluddin Rumi, in Persian, as part of the work he was doing with a learning community. They are all meant to open the heart or to explore the mysteries, various mysteries. One of them being the longing he felt was at the core of every human being. Nobody knows what that longing is for. It's probably not for real estate or one's own radio program. But this is his poem in celebration of that. One night. One night. A man was crying, Allah, Allah. His lips grew sweet with the praises, until a cynic said, so. I've heard you calling out, had no answer for that. He quit praying. He quit praying and fell into a confused sleep, where he dreamed he saw Hidr, the guide of souls, in a thick green foliage. Why did you stop praising? Why did you stop praising? Because I never heard anything back. This longing you express is the return. Thank you. One of the mysteries they examine in those communities is that of the beloved or the friend. This mysterious presence we can't say much about inside the senses and outside. It's that kingdom of God that Jesus talks about in the Gospel of Thomas. It's inside you and all around you. Break a stick and I am there. Lift up a stone and I am there. And in Persian, I'm told, there is a pronoun that means I, you, he, she, it, we, you, they, and God. And we don't have that in English. So we have to make do with the second person, singular and plural, that heartbreaking, poignant pronoun, you. It's pretty good. So when Rumi addresses that mystery, I use the word you for it. And here's a poem about that addresses that you. He says, when it's cold and raining, you are more beautiful. When it's cold and raining, feels it in the weather. When it's cold and raining, you are more beautiful. And the snow brings me even closer to your lips. The inner secret, that which was never born, you are that freshness. And I am with you now. I can't explain the goings or the comings. You enter suddenly, and I am nowhere again inside the majesty. Sufi circles is that there are three ways of approaching the mystery, that whatever that is inside all of our pronouns. and inside the weather. They say that it's as prayer, and to step up from that, there's meditation, the deep centering, and to step up from that is conversation, some kind of call and response inside ourselves and maybe outside too. So they might have talked about walking and laughing and dreaming and breathing and telling jokes and looking up words in the dictionary and eating pie and playing tag. But they talk about, they bring it down to prayer, meditation, and conversation. And they say there's important results of this listening to this inner conversation. And it's the qualities that come from that are modesty and generosity and strength and handsomeness. The opening of the heart. So here's his poem about that inner conversation and what happens because of it. What was said to the rose that made it open was said to me here in my chest. What was told the cypress that made it strong and straight. What was whispered the jasmine, so it is what it is. whatever made sugar cane sweet, whatever was said to the inhabitants of the town of Chigil in Turkestan that makes them so handsome, whatever lets the pomegranate flower blush like a human face, that is being said to me now. I blush. Whatever put eloquence in language, that's happening here. That takes some daring to say as a poet, doesn't it? Whatever put eloquence, that's happening right now. I'm doing it. Yeah. The great warehouse doors open, and I feel with gratitude, chewing a piece of sugar cane. In love with the one to whom every that belongs. What was said to the rose that made it open was said to me here in my chest. What was told the cypress that made it strong and straight. What was whispered the jasmine, so it is what it is. Whatever made sugar cane sweet, whatever put eloquence in language, that's happening here. The great warehouse doors open, and I feel with gratitude all that abundance is like that. Chewing a piece of sugar cane, in love with the one to whom every that belongs. I have never read Rumi with the vibes. It works, doesn't it? Yeah. This next poem, the State Department in their wisdom decided that I needed to go to Afghanistan in March 2005, and I, in my ignorance, I went, and it was great fun. And so I found myself in the Ministry of Culture in Kabul, and we don't have a Ministry of Culture, do we? Where would it be? Taos, probably. Or Asheville. It could be in Asheville. Yeah, that would be good. What would we just set one up? This is the Ministry of Culture. They have one there. And I was reading this poem to them. I realized that everybody in the room was saying the poem, you know, in the original. They, thank God they recognized it, you know. That after they got over, they started arguing. And I asked my translator, I said, should I leave or what? He said, oh, this is very interesting. They're arguing about the metaphor of drunkenness in this poem and in the Hafez's use of wine. And it was a lively argument. Can you imagine in Bush's cabinet there was an argument about some imagery of Stevens and Frost? This is not going to happen. But they were jumping around and scouting, and finally the Minister of Culture, this little wiry man, jumped up and he said something, and I said, what did he say? He said, but it seemed everybody said, oh, sure, yeah, but, and it solved the argument. He said, inside this one Rumi poem, there are 16 little drunken Hafezes running around. And what he meant was that the Rumi's embrace of ecstatic love, the drunkenness, included Hafez's tweaking of the imams about the use of wine. And so I don't know, that's what it sounds right, doesn't it? But anyway, it just the extravagance and spontaneity of his image solved the argument. And so this is the poem, and we're going to translate it all the way across by doing it with the blues. Thank you. think about it. Then at night, I say it. Where did I come from? And what am I supposed to be doing? I have no idea. My soul is from elsewhere. I'm sure of that. And I intend to end up there. This drunkenness began in some other tavern. When I get back around to that place, I'll be completely sober. Meanwhile, I'm like a bird from another continent, sitting in this aviary. The day is coming when I fly off. But who is it now in my ear who hears my voice? Who says words with my mouth? Who looks out with my eyes? What is the soul? I cannot stop asking. If I could taste one sip of an answer, I could break out of this prison for drunks. I didn't come here of my own accord, and I can't leave that way. Whoever brought me here will have to take me home. Whoever brought me here will have to take me home. Whoever brought me here will have to take me home. This poetry, I never know what I'm going to say. I don't plan it. When I'm outside the saying of it, I get very quiet and rarely speak at all. I used to think that was the end of the poem. But my translator in Afghanistan said, no, it goes on one stanza more. He does a little aside to his teacher. Shams Tabriz, if you could show your face to me again, I could flee the imposition of this life. In the last 20, 30 years, there's been a lot of speculation about what stories are to the human community. And speculation is that poems and stories are to human growth as facts are to science. That is, they are that basic. The ascetic masters in Eastern Europe said that God created the world because he loves stories. So you're here to be a good story. So try. My teacher, Bawa Muhyiddin, used to say, there will come a time when you and God are sitting and watching the movie of your life. So try to make some parts that he'll enjoy. Yeah, don't do the same thing over and over. Be a little generous. Here's Robert Penn Warren's poem about the ache that we have. In us for stories. Long ago in Kentucky, I, a boy, stood by a dirt road in first dark and heard the great geese hoot northward. I could not see them, there being no moon and the stars sparse. I heard them. I did not know what was happening in my heart. It was a time before the elderberry blooms. Therefore, they were going north. The sound was passing northward. Tell me a story. In this century and moment of mania, tell me a story. Make it a story of great distances and starlight. story will be time, but you must not mention its name. Tell me a story of deep delight. Long ago in Kentucky, I, a boy, stood by a dirt road in first dark and heard the great geese hoot northward. I could not see them. There'd be no moon in the stars sparse. I heard them. I did not know what was happening in my heart. Here's a story by Jalaluddin Rumi, accompanied by a wonderful Hasidic song. Three devout men of different religions fall in together by chance traveling. They stop at a caravanserai where the host brings as a gift a sweet dessert, some taste of God's nearness. This is how people out in the country serve strangers. The Jew and the Christian are full, but the Muslim has been fasting all day. The two say, let's save it for tomorrow. The one, no, let's save self-denial for tomorrow. You want it all for yourself. Divide it into three parts and each can do as he wants. Ah, but Muhammad said not to share. That was about dividing yourself between sensuality and soul. You must belong to one or the other. But finally, for some reason, he gives in. I'll do it your way. They refrain from tasting. They sleep and then wake and dress themselves to begin morning devotions. Christian, Jew, Muslim, shaman, Zoroastrian, stone, ground, mountain, river. Each has a secret way of being with the mystery, unique and not to be judged. This subject never ends. Three friends in a grand morning mood. Let us tell what dreams we had last night. Whoever has had the deepest dream gets the halva. Agreed. The Jewish man begins the wanderings of his soul. Moses met me on the road. I followed him to Sinai, an opening door, light within light. Mount Sinai and Moses and I emerged in an exploding splendor, the unity of the prophets. This is a true dream. Many Jews have such. Then the Christian sighs. Christ took me in his arms to the fourth heaven, a poor, vast region I cannot say. His is also deep, the Muslim. Muhammad came and told me where you two had gone. You wretch, he said, you've been left behind. You may as well get up and eat something. No, laughed the Christian and the Jew. How could I disobey such glory? Would you not do as Moses and Jesus suggest? You're right, they say, you're right. Yours is the truest dream because it had immediate effect in your waking life. What matters is how quickly you do what your soul directs. What matters is how quickly you do Rumi's community, they were always aware of various transitions from states of awareness to another, and they always noticed how human consciousness changes a little when you're about to hear a joke. So they talked a lot about Najruddin. I've collected a lot of Najruddin stories. In Afghanistan, they know more than hundreds of them. They're just wonderful. Anytime you mention Najruddin, everybody begins talking. Najruddin takes a tuna fish sandwich to work for lunch every day. And every day, he takes one bite and says, yuck, and throws it away. His co-worker, after a while, says, Najruddin, why don't you have your wife fix some other kind of sandwich? He says, ah, my friend, it is not so simple. I'm not married. I make these for myself. Najruddin knows the importance of getting enough exercise. He says, my mother, when she was 60 years old, began walking 5 miles a day, and now she's 90, and we have no idea where she is. I dropped in on Najruddin one Saturday afternoon, and he's sitting on his porch. I said, what's on TV? He said, dust. Najruddin is out by his lake, his country place. He's sitting there by the pond. Man comes up and asks, how deep is your pond, Najruddin? He thinks of it and says, pulls a thumb across his collarbone and says, it comes up to here on my ducks. My son Benjamin said, Dad, these are not Najruddin jokes, these are Bubba jokes. Najruddin has told the actuarial statistic about how most automobile accidents happen within a mile of your own home, so he moves. If you hear 7 Najruddin jokes in a row, you become enlightened. Yeah, we'll get there. We'll do 14.
That's right.
Najruddin is walking through a village, and he sees a number of bullseyes painted on a wall, each at different heights and different distances apart, and a perfect bullseye in the middle of every one. And a young man with a rifle is standing nearby. He says, how did you become such a perfect marksman? He says, easy. I shot first and then drew bullseyes around the shot, and that way I get a bullseye every time. Najruddin reflects that the young man, there's something deceitful in the young man's life, but it has practical application. He has solved the problem we all have with being off-center. Here's one that, kind of another one like that. It's one that nobody has ever laughed at. Najruddin has a magic wand. He waves it and he conjures up a patent office with the patent officer behind the desk, and he says, I'd like to get a patent on this magic wand. And you're perfect for this. And the patent officer said, we don't give patents on those new age paraphernalia. And so he waves the wand, and the man disappears. I guess it is a joke. I wondered about that one. Najruddin is walking and along with me one day, and it begins raining, and he has an umbrella with him. And I say, Najruddin, why don't you open your umbrella? He says, oh, it's all in shreds. It's no good. I said, well, why did you bring it? He said, I didn't think it would rain. Najruddin is drunk. It's 4 a.m. He's walking out of the tavern and aimlessly wandering the streets. The police stop him and say, Najruddin, why are you out wandering the streets at this hour of the night? And he says, sir, if I knew the answer to that question, I would have been home hours ago. Najruddin buys a prize rooster and brings it home and it begins servicing the hens in his barnyard, and then it moves on to the ducks and the geese and the cat and the dog and sheep. And he comes out and he says, I did not pay such an exorbitant price for you to have you make a chaos of my farm. And besides, if you're going to continue this relentless sexual activity, you're going to kill yourself. The rooster pays no attention. And the next day, Nasruddin looks out there, sees the rooster dead on the ground, the buzzard is circling down. He goes out to lecture the corpse. He says, I told you I'd have to... The rooster opens one eye and says, shh. When you're romancing a buzzard, you have to play it their way.
Shindig on the Green, starting June 28th, Saturday, around 7 o'clock. It's a joyously spontaneous celebration of traditional and old-time string bands, bluegrass, ballad singers, big circle mountain dancers, and cloggers on summer Saturday evenings in downtown Asheville. Stage show and informational jam sessions. It's located on Martin Luther King Jr., in Martin Luther King Jr. Park in downtown Asheville. Bring a lawn chair or blanket, family, and friends. The dates are as follows: June 28th, July 5th, July 12th, July 19th, August 9th, August 16th, 23rd, and 30th. For free information, please call area code 828-258-6101, extension 345, or go to www.folkheritage.org. Again, that's www.folkheritage.org. Shindig on the Green.
And you're listening to WPVM FM, Asheville, 103.5, the progressive voice of the mountains. And we've been listening today to Coleman Barks performing at the Fine Arts Theater with Elliot Wadapin and Brian Hedgepath. And we're going to get back to that performance in a few minutes. But first, we're going to check on an interview we actually did here in the studios with Coleman.
Was that the day of? Did you catch him before or after?
No, this was back in March.
Oh, that one.
That one.
I was there for that one.
You were there for part of it. You just rolled your car, though.
Yeah, it was a wreck.
So you were a wreck. Right.
Yeah. Literally.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. The wreck made me a wreck. Okay. So I was there in body, but...
Yeah.
Okay. Enough about that.
Here we go. How many poems of Rumi's have you translated now?
Gosh, I'm not counting.
You're not counting. Oh, yeah.
There's 16 books. That's...
Right. Yeah. So he wrote thousands of poems.
Just thousands and thousands. Nobody knows how that creativity existed.
Yeah, I mean, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, he must have, and he spoke them spontaneously in Persian.
That's
right. Part of the work he was doing with the Dervish learning community. And we're lucky with Rumi because his scribes took them down, and he had a team of scribes that whenever he said anything. Yeah. He took them down, the discourses. We've got 147 of his letters from the 13th century.
Wow.
How do these things survive? We don't know, but the community has been continuous.
Right.
And so they kept them.
They were passed down.
Yeah. And so what we have in Rumi's poetry is spontaneously spoken words that are in answer, perhaps, to some question that was asked in the community, whether it was out loud or whether it was implicit, we don't know. But he was teaching always. His poems were meant to be guidance and to open the heart of what the work of the community was. Mm-hmm. And everything they did was for that.
Do we know much about the community, how large it was?
About 400.
About 400 people,
yeah.
Wow.
And, of course, it had visitors coming and going. Mm-hmm. And they used silence, and they used music, and they used jokes and stories and feasting and fasting. And they went for walks, and they tended gardens, and they tended orchards, and they watched the behavior of animals. They read animal behavior as a kind of a scripture. I love that about them.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so they this whole practice of sama, of just listening, to the teacher. Rumi was their heart master, and to just whatever is going on around you. They were sort of like John Cage. You know, they listened to the ambient noise, and
right.
Whatever was happening was part of the art, of,
the
that,
art.
Of that community. Rumi often includes spontaneously things that come into, like children running through, or a calf and a mother, a cow coming through,
mm-hmm.
and he'll say, "We're like them." He'll use whatever mm-hmm. happens in the instant as part of his teaching.
Yeah,
and so it's gorgeously, it's jazz. It's a kind of sublime jazz.
When you've probably been asked this 1,000 times, but how did you come to translate Rumi? What got you involved?
Well, Robert Bly is one strand of it.
Mm-hmm.
In 1976, he handed me a book of scholarly translations, and he said, "These poems need to be released from their cages." Robert Bly sounds a little bit like W.C. Fields. "I'd rather be in Philadelphia." So Robert told me to do this, and he had an amazing sense. He told Jane Kenyon to translate Anna Akhmatova, too.
Hmm.
And Jane did a great job of that.
Yeah.
So anyway, I began rephrasing these English scholarly translations of the ghazals of Rumi. Every afternoon, I would go down to the Bluebird restaurant after I'd taught 3 classes, and explicated poems mm-hmm. all day, and fall into the region of these poems. And they were not poems that could be explicated.
Mm-hmm.
They were poems that had to be inhabited. And you went into the region of them, and they felt so deeply relaxing and nourishing to me. And so I just kept doing it as a kind of a practice to mm-hmm. make myself sane
uh-huh.
after using my mind all day.
Yeah. Right. Right.
And so that's one strand of it. There are a couple of other strands. One of them involves a precognitive dream, which you can believe or not. You mm-hmm. know, I don't have the luxury of not believing it because it happened to me.
Right. Right.
May 2nd, 1977. It's my holy day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's the day of the dream.
Day of the dream. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I woke up inside a dream, and I was sleeping by the Tennessee River, right where I grew up there. And I was still asleep, but I was awake. You know, it was lucid time. And a ball of light came up off of Williams Island and came over above me and clarified from the inside out. And there was a man sitting there, and he was white shawl over his head, and he raised his head, and he said, "I love you." And I said, "I love you too." And the whole landscape then felt drenched with dew, a kind of a wetness through everything. And that dew was love. So you know how you know things in dreams. Mm-hmm. Some of it, that was just obvious. And so then a year and a half later, I met that man in Philadelphia. His name was Bawa Mujahideen. And he told me to do this Rumi work. And as far as I know, he helps with it. Because I would not, he was on the same level as Rumi's consciousness, and I am not. And so whenever I work on these poems, I feel connected again to my teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another strand of this, and that is that when I was growing up, I was a geography freak. I love maps and globes and things. And
right.
And 5 or 6 years old, I knew all the capitals of all the countries in the world, just from the Rand McNally Atlas I'd looked at so much.
Yeah.
And as I say, I grew up at a prep school, and going over to the dining hall every night across the quadrangle, people would call out names of countries. And this little smart aleck child that I was, I would call out the capital, and they would say Bulgaria, and I would say Sofia, and they would say Uruguay, and I would say Montevideo, and they'd say Tanganyika, and the country doesn't even exist anymore.
Right.
But I would say
right.
Dar es Salaam.
Right.
Yeah. And I still know them. Anyway, and so this Latin teacher, often in a private school, I'm told, the Latin teacher will be the goofy, ecstatic one. Mm-hmm. And he certainly was in this school. And he went down into his basement classroom in the chapel and got a country that did not seem to have a capital. On his map, it didn't. I remember that map. And he came out and yelled at me across the quadrangle, "Cappadocia! Cappadocia!" He said the look on my face when I went through the perfect computer of my brain and did not find a capital. He said that named me. So there's still people in Chattanooga that call me Cappadocia. Or Cap.
Cap.
Yeah.
Right.
And so a few years ago, I almost fell down when I realized that the central city in Cappadocia, that region of Anatolia, was Iconium, or Konya, where Rumi lived and was buried.
Wow.
So the universe was playing a little joke on me.
Indeed.
Wondering if I would get it.
Yeah.
That, my friend, you are named for your ignorance. and my what I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, so it's humbling, this work with Rumi. Mm-hmm. I'm told that the Rumi books sell 100 copies a day, right through the weekend and all holidays.
That's amazing.
And my own poems sell 12 copies a month worldwide. Yeah. And so there's the humility built into the practice here.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's amazing work. And
well, it's just food and drink to me. It's not work at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a truly remarkable work. And you introduced, I think, to the American public, an important teacher, an important poet that otherwise would have been sitting there in those, you know, scholarly translations.
Well, it's true that six of the greatest of 10 poets in the world are right in the Persian language from the 12th to the 15th century. Mm-hmm. And they are just like the crown jewel. Mm-hmm. Of world poetry. And we are only just now coming to know two of them, mm-hmm. Rumi and Hafez.
Yeah.
And of course there's Attar and Sa'di and Sinai. Mm-hmm. And there are a whole bunch of them that we don't know, that these poets, that Rumi had absorbed totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that he knew them all. Here are some quatrains by Jalaluddin Rumi. Pale sunlight, pale the wall. Love moves away. The light changes. I need more grace than I thought. There is a light seed grain inside. You fill it with yourself, or it dies. I'm caught in this curling energy, your hair. Whoever is calm and sensible is insane. Love that. Take that, you psychologist.
Right.
Whoever is calm and sensible is insane.
listening to WPVM 103.5, the progressive voice of the mountains in Asheville, North Carolina. And we've been listening to an interview with Colin Barks conducted here in the studios back in March of this year. And then we're going to go back and catch the last of his performance in April for WordFest.
Most of my own poems cluster around times, boundary times, like retiring from teaching, having children, the death of parents, divorce, becoming a grandparent, those kinds of things. And here's one about the boundary of when I have two sons, and when they both went off to college, and I was sort of not a parent anymore. Are you approaching that?
I'm loving that.
And I was the first in my family to be divorced, and the first not to take my children to church. And this is trying to forgive myself for what I didn't give them and to celebrate what I did. My wife was a folklorist, and she and I and her teacher at Chapel Hill, Dan Patterson, used to come up here to these mountains and to these old shape note hymn singings out in places, you know, Brushy Mountain or something, I don't know, places that didn't even know about Asheville. Asheville was like Babylon or something. They never went into Asheville. And I stood close enough to Raymond Hamrick so that I learned the bass part of the old fa sol la shape note singing. And so there's a little singing in here. I used to sing my kids to sleep with it. But the scene here is called New Year's Day Nap. And one of my sons, Cole, is sleeping on a couch in all his New Year's Eve finery. And I'm watching a football game on television. So it begins that way. Fiesta Bowl on low. That's a good American line, isn't it? Fiesta Bowl on low. My son lying here on the couch. On the dad pillow he made for me in the seventh grade. Now a sophomore at Georgia Southern, driving back later today. He sleeps with his white top hat over his face. I'm a dancing fool. 20 years ago, half the form he sleeps within came out of nowhere with a million micro lemmings who all died but one piercer of membrane, specially picked to start a brain-making egg drop soup that stirred two sun and moon centers for a new painted sky in the tiniest ballroom imaginable. Let's call it tour de force. Now he's rousing, 6 feet long, turning on his side. Now he's gone. I sound low key, but this is the way I howl an old hymn in the plaintive bass drone, a charm for accepting what happens and a stubborn question. Say, why in the valley of death should I weep or alone in the wilderness rove? There's no one to worry about waking with my singing. I have loved them, those two boys, so well that they've left. We're after the fact now, out in nowhere again. We're I. And I am a line of music, wriggling along like water, wanting to be ocean. The cedars of Lebanon bow at his feet. The air is perfumed with his breath. Singing and talking, one vibrates with the other. Vapor mist going up this way, cloud come back around down. The old fa sol la singers would not commit to words until they ran through the notes and broken lines of rain. The reverse of me, rocking my babies to all verses of Samantha or David's lamentation, who now in a shower somewhere murmur tunes they have no lyrics for. La, la, mi, la, so, do, mi, so, mi, mi. I never took them to church or told them stories about David or Samuel or Jesus. But they move like fish or tadpole radios in the mud, flat on their backs on a roof or breezing by. Maybe any motion is holy music, not only theirs. Remember how it went, then forget it. Sliding, forget more. Sliding air in the throat, this song, it seems so soon to quit. Any shred of unfinished existence, a la la so so me, that somehow is unbelievably over. The growing of the corn, over and over. Our watery bodies keep moving, hands give, eyes weep, feet walk, shoulders swim, the throat sings, the chest hopes, the genitals wait, and the thighs, their small stroke dancing work of balancing and lifting the thighs. Slow move, a big river-like forgiveness. We can jump in, I and my strong boys, now men. Some songs don't ever get completely sung. They're sung by the blood, inside creeks and rocks and air, in some cellular Beulah land. The harmonizing water sings them. Fa-di-do, so fa mi, la mi, re, do, ti, la, ti, do, mi, la. Thank you, folks. We really appreciate you listening. Elliot, my baby, Byron, his dad.
You've been listening to Coleman Barks reading at the Fine Arts Theater on the 27th of April, 2008. And that's Wordplay for today. Join us again next week.
See you around.